I'm Framery Kennedy from the Aspen Health Policy Program, and I'm very happy to actually be introducing new consumerism in healthcare. And first, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Booz Allen, for their generous support and their continued support, as well as our media partner, The Atlantic. And with that, I'd also like to invite everyone back in October for our first Aspen Health Forum. It's October 3rd through the 4th, and you'll see the brochures everywhere. And with that, I will have David Bradley begin the session.
Thank you, Fran. Am I wired up? Can you hear me? Yes. Good afternoon. Welcome. Let me settle into conversation as well with a word about Booz Allen. We very much appreciate their sponsorship of the whole track and their sponsorship of this program. Over the years, Booz has ended up working for almost every major health insurer, academic medical center, health system in the country. Where two or more are gathered in the name of intelligence, you often will find Booz Allen Hamilton. Thank you for doing this. A few years ago, I was on a flight from Houston to Washington, D.C. It was a late evening continental flight, and it was late, and it was so late that we missed the curfew in Washington and ended up having to overfly to Dulles Airport, and we arrived there at 12:30 or so, and because they hadn't expected the flight, there were no baggage handlers, and so about 50 of us ended up standing around the baggage carousel for over an hour, and I was watching, and one of the men in the group was really interesting, and there were two interesting things about him. He was friendly and effusive and chatting with everybody. And second, it was Antonin Scalia, the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. So then the bags arrived, except about 10 of us didn't get bags. And we ended up in a, you know, the line where you turn in your claim stub? And he was right behind me. So I said, too obsequiously by half, Justice Scalia, rank should have privilege here. Why don't you go ahead of me? And he said, no, that's all right. I'll just come up and talk with you. And then he leaned over and he whispered these words: if Continental Airlines ever comes before the Supreme Court, they're going to learn to regret this evening. I have moderated three panels so far for this Ideas Festival. One was just pure joy to do. It was whether the economic miracle in China is sustainable. And we had economists and China hands, and it was a directed, purposeful conversation. Another that I did was enormous fun, but it was utter intellectual chaos. That was a session on educating the next generation of leaders for America. It had really smart people on the panel: President of the University of Pennsylvania, President of the University of Chicago, President of the American Museum of Natural History. But the problem is, when you use words like education and leadership, the conversation just bleeds everywhere. So we talked about leadership skills, standardized testing, university finances, K-12 education, early learning, the problem of the inner city, teachers' unions, immigration law, and the rise of China and India as competitors to U.S. universities. It was a cacophonous mess, and I lost control of it very early in the conversation. I tried to regather the conversation at the end just by doing what we will all agree was very modest humor. I said to the audience as we were closing, well, I give you an introduction to all our panelists explaining their force of IQ. What I didn't tell you is how generous they are. And before we got together here in the Fuller session, in the spirit of Aspen, each one of them wanted me to offer on their behalf, if you would like any help getting your children into these universities they want to be in person, which it got about that much laughter there. Stone silence up here. So I did a poor job. I lost control of the conversation. My children aren't going to those two schools. And you have this sort of Antonin Scalia moment of regretting. I'm never doing that again. He opened the brochure, and there it is: healthcare reform, consumerism in healthcare. If there's any topic that's more complex and a puffier, handsomer topic than education reform, it's healthcare reform. So what I would like to do is introduce our individual panel members. I'm going to come back and do a really quick primer, 2 minutes, on what we generally mean, what are the topics within consumer healthcare, and expressly what's not within that topic. The panel's agreed to make opening statements. Maybe I'll ask a question or two, but largely what we're doing is shifting the burden of conversation to you. To my immediate right is Gary Alquist. Gary is a senior vice president at Booz Allen Hamilton. I know very little about him, having just met him today, but he must be a rainmaker for the enterprise. He's worked for over 50 of the largest academic medical centers and health systems and health plans around the country. He is also my cheat sheet. I received in my pack, and you now have beside you, an article that is coming out in Strategy and Business on consumer healthcare. And working to pretend that I'm masterful in this field, I relied heavily on that. Welcome. To his right is Dr. Reed Tuckson. Reed is the senior, the executive vice president and the chief of the chief medical officer for United Healthcare Group. I know two things with certainty, though I've only met Reed today. The first is I used to own a company called the Advisory Board that did research for 2,000 hospitals around the country. And as to health insurance, predictably United was the most intelligent, often the most progressive, always the most successful. And their particular success was often, where we ended up studying them, was management of the physician practices, clinical protocols and information systems therein, exactly what Reed does. The other thing I know with certainty is I am so glad not to have done Reed's career. It is really hard. The United position is difficult. They have 550,000 doctors whose work they oversee. They, quote, oversee. They have 23 million enrollees. He had the presidency of a medical school. It was a fledgling large medical school in South LA. Every one of those words is hard. Fledgling large medical school is just incomparably hard to manage. In South LA, it was a medical school named the Charles Drew University of Medicine that rose up after some riots and civil disturbance in the 1960s in LA. And you can imagine what a hard task that was. And then he was the commissioner of public health for the District of Columbia. That speaks for itself, right? Don't need to go farther on that. To his right is Dr. Victor Zhao. Victor is the chancellor for the for health affairs at Duke University, which has with it the qualified blessing that you get to manage the whole health system, the hospital and the doctors as well. He did his Stations of the Cross at Harvard. He had an endowed chair at the medical school, and he was chairman of medicine at the Brigham and Women's. Every photo that I saw on Victor, given to me after we had done a search on him, had him in a white coat. That is a badge of honor in medicine. The doctors who step forward to leadership positions, administrative leadership positions, cleave into two. There is a group that continues to have a medical practice or a wet lab, and for those that do that, they wear the white coat, and that's a badge of honor. If you were hosting a dinner party in the United States, or if you were attending a dinner party in Washington, and it was a very important dinner party, and the very important dinner party could have all the very important people that they wanted, and you were to look at the hostess and then look to her right, there's a good chance you would see Congressman Rahm Emanuel. Within the Democratic side of politics in Washington, this is as ascendant a star as we have in our firmament. He did an extraordinary run in Illinois politics. Remember Senator Paul Simon, worked for him for the mayoralty of Richard Daley. Then when President Clinton came into Washington, Rahm became a national figure, becoming a counselor to the president at the White House. When the president left office, Rahm did investment banking just long enough not to become wealthy and just long enough not to be indicted. And then
I thought you were describing my White House years there.
Then in 2002, ran for Congress in the 5th District of Illinois, a Chicago district, won it, and then began the vertical run up through the ranks of the House membership. He was chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which, if you were a Democrat, was a very successful thing. They added 30 seats in this last election round in 2006, and that presumably contributed to the fact that he was elected to the fourth most significant position in the House, the chairman of the Democratic caucus. Quick primer on consumerism and healthcare. There are some topics consumerism almost always covers in healthcare. Number one, though there's often code used for it, is how do we control costs in healthcare? There's a sense that this has been very difficult for the federal government to do, managing the cost of healthcare. It's also been difficult for employers and for insurers to do. So there's this quaternary theory that if we had a group of consumers who were paying out of their pocket for healthcare, you might find more prudential purchasers. You might find them taking care of themselves earlier on, or electing not to do elected things, or actually price shopping for the care that they get. This is a difficult thing to accomplish in the healthcare system. Politically, it's difficult because it means shifting costs more directly to the individual consumer as opposed to through the corporation or the health plan or through Medicare. But it is a hot topic within healthcare circles. This, by the way, is the bio of Rahm. It keeps falling on the ground. I actually carry it with me all the time, independent of these sessions. So that's why it's a separate piece of paper.
I'm glad it's in pencil.
Fourth most significant, third most significant. The purchasing, that second topic is the purchasing, the information you would want as a consumer purchasing healthcare if we had a purchaser's market. So, for example, you'd love to know by doctor, outcomes by procedure. You'd love to know that for hospital as well. This is an unbelievably complex IT task, to which probably the insurers are best qualified to do it, but it's also an extremely difficult task politically. It is not the first thing a doctor aspires to have his practice measured on quantitative metrics and then reported to the public. But it, too, is a conversation that galvanizes attention. Third topic is sort of a fun topic. There's just a lot of experimentation going on with new consumer services. If it were a consumer market, you'd want one-minute clinics, or you'd want what's known as concierge services. I may rely on Gary to do a little bit of that introduction. The danger in a healthcare conversation is no matter what the sentence begins with, you end talking about the issue of access, the 45.8 million people who are uninsured in healthcare. And the problem for us as a session is there's a dedicated Aspen Ideas Festival session on this tomorrow at 12:30 in Doerr Hosier Center. We are replacing Rahm with his brother Ezekiel to do that session, and we probably should leave them some intellectual property to talk about. So to the extent I can, what I'm going to start with the first three panelists is saying, let's do topics that lie within this consumer terrain, but as we get to politics and what the House and a White House might do, it's irresistible to also talk something about access. Gary, I'd love to turn it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to cover two topics in my opening remarks. First is the case for change. Why is it that we need not just reform, but in our view, a revolution in the healthcare system in the United States? And second, talk about a couple of the key features of what a better system might look like. First, on the case for change. It's often overlooked, but pretty obvious when you think about it, that there are two things which drive healthcare costs in this country. And it's not doctors and it's not hospitals. Number one is bad behavior, and number two is aging. It's hard to avoid the second. There's a lot we can do with the first. And I'm not talking about Paris Hilton bad behavior, although that may catch up with her later. But I'm talking basically about what it is we put inside our bodies and what we do with our bodies over our lifetime. And something like, people argue about it, between half and three quarters of the costs in this country are driven by bad behavior. When I was on my way out here, I was catching up with my reading, and I was flipping through Crane Chicago, which is a weekly in Chicago, and they had sort of their issue of lists, and they did one on healthcare, and it's about obesity. And it shows the annual costs for normal, sort of overweight and obese. So let's leave overweight out, even though that's 36% of the population in the state of Illinois. The obese folks require almost $6,000 a year of costs of healthcare consumption, drugs, outpatient care, and hospitalization. Normal weighted folks is about $3,000, so it's double. And in the state of Illinois, 24%, about a quarter of the population, qualifies as obese. By the way, I did my body mass index in the plane on the way out. I'd never known it, and thankfully I turned out okay. If you want to know the calculation, it's in here. Aging is obviously drives a lot of healthcare costs. Well, what's the issue with aging? There are 75, I'm one of them, I suspect everybody up here, well, maybe Rahm's too young, but are in this baby boomer cohort, 75 million of us turning 65 every day for the next 25 to 30 years. Healthcare costs go up geometrically with age, particularly over the age of 60 and 65. So we know that on top of what is already a very high-cost system that is driving many corporations to change the way they cover their employees. We have pressure building through bad behavior and an aging population. The next thing is that the system itself, those of you, all of us who enter the system, is a particularly oblique, complicated, fragmented system, one that is very scary and difficult to negotiate, just the way it currently sits. We, of course, have talked about the uninsured. And finally, I would say, you know, we've had a system in this country for the last 20 years. We don't use the term anymore, which was called managed care. It in itself wasn't a bad idea. It was to try to get folks into their doctor and that doctor would take care of them through a panel of physicians and others over their lifetime. It didn't work out the way it was intended to, but we've rejected that largely as a society at this point. So there's only one question now left, which is if we took the old system, the managed care system, and we've said we don't want that, what's next? This discussion here is about perhaps if we really do put consumers in the middle and arm them with the kind of information, incentives, and education that we need, we can make this a better system. That doesn't mean consumers can do it alone. There's a lot that has to happen. Let me talk about those three things. First, incentives. We do have a real fundamental problem with incentives, misalignment of incentives. First of all, as consumers, we have a very short-term incentive. Our insurance is an annual. When you lose it at the end of a year, if you don't consume what's in there, you have to start over. So it causes people to have very short-term thinking. And because it's insurance, as you've read about this, people tend not to know what the cost of it is that they're consuming. And therefore, will make suboptimal decisions. Let's talk about physicians. Physicians obviously are the heroes of the medical system, but physicians are paid on inputs, not on results. They are paid for piecework, which generally leads to, while wanting to do the right thing, in order to get whatever income I'm going to get, I need to do more, not less. Now, that clearly conflicts with the attitude that our physicians have, but at the end of the day, there is an economic incentive to do more. This morning, there was an interesting panel on collaboration in curing cancer. And this is very, sort of really flies under the radar screen, but they made a very elegant point, which is even at the basic science level, physicians are not incented to collaborate. They are incented to be sole providers, sole researchers. In fact, one of the physicians made the point that if you do your research and you do it off the backs of these collaboratives, these cooperatives that form to try to get more data on cancer, it actually harms your chances of getting tenure at a prestigious university. So, of course, your incentive is to go alone, which carries all the way through the ranks. What do we need? We need to take the incentive for short-term consumption of consumers to a long-tailed view over my lifetime. We need to take the incentives for physicians from inputs to outputs to results. We need to take the incentives from basic science, biomedical research, from solo practitioners or solo research to collaboration. And we need employers to stop worrying about costs as their primary, the factor that they worry about most, and worry about productivity, which relates, of course, to health status. We lost the productivity discussion decades ago, and we need the employers to get back to that because that is what, at the end of the day, drives our capitalist system. Now, information. You can't have incentives without information. We recently did research on 6,000 consumers on Booz Allen's behalf, and we asked them many questions, but one of the questions that we asked was, how would you like to get information? And we gave them a whole laundry list of places where they could get information, health plans, employers, physicians, pharmacists. The number one, what do you think was the number one unaided response to where they would like to get their information on healthcare? Doctor was number three. Internet was close. What they said was, we gave them a choice of internet, and we gave them something like Trusted Source, Consumer Reports. That came up number one by far and away. Number two was physicians. The bottom four, sorry to say, were health plans, employers, government, and pharmaceuticals, pretty much the folks who kind of run the system today. So we have a problem. Consumers want information, but they want it from trusted sources. Back to the incentives, Physicians would tell you, it's hard for me to give them that information. That requires more time. I've got to see 25 patients today. I can't afford to spend 45 minutes. I've got to get them in and out in 20 minutes to make the economics work. We need to change the incentives so the trusted source who can translate this for us has the time and the incentive to do the right thing. Last thing I'll mention very briefly is education. This doesn't get talked about enough, but my own view is we may want to give up on us oldies and say, you know, you guys go figure it out. But there's generations behind us that I believe we ought to start educating now. I know we're trying to work on reading, writing, and arithmetic, get that right. But believe me, if we could spend an hour a week educating our children about healthcare, about the healthcare system, about diseases, about these kinds of things, we would have informed, shoppable consumers, shopper-ready consumers 20 years from now. And it's going to take us 20 years to change this thing anyway, so we might as well start with the next generation. That for sure means that my time is up. And work with them. Thank you.
Thank you. Reed?
Well, thank you. Let me try to take some of those important points and drill a little further. This idea of consumerism, really, this notion that people will be more engaged in their own health is an inevitable response to the problems that you just heard about. And those problems, in addition to behavior, are really clearly, obviously, cost escalation, but also poor quality in healthcare. We really know today a whole lot that tells us that about half the time, healthcare is delivered consistent with the best evidence-based science. A big part of that is that people are very much involved in influencing the care delivery system around what choices are made and the use of assets. And what is clear as a problem is we have suboptimal use of existing healthcare assets. And so now here we have the opportunity, just like in every other part of our lives and in healthcare, is to help people and, in fact, provide more than just help, but an incentive for people to get more engaged in making better choices and more decisions. And so what that ultimately will sort of say is that in healthcare today, one of the most important concepts is patient or individual-centric care. We now realize that as important as the physician is, as important as the hospital is, at the end of the day, what's really important is what do you need? And what you need is different than what you need. You need different hospitals, different kind of physicians, different kinds of information, different sources of information. And so we have to now move to a place, which is exciting, to get people to that. So what does all that look like in real time today, and where are we? Well, first and foremost, what this sort of looks like is that there is a conceptual model that says that we have to, in healthcare, begin to decide that the person is more important than our own institutions. And so even though our building has been here for 912 million years and we've always been doing it this way, and I don't care, you know, it's a round peg, got to fit through our square hole, but we don't care because we're the big hospital or we're the big clinic system. At the end of the day, we're all trying to say, wait a minute, maybe Mrs. Jones is the most important, and we have to find a way to track Mrs. Jones across all the places of care delivery. It is important that we are aging. What is more important than that we are aging is that we have chronic disease, and each of us has probably more than one chronic disease as we get older. Therefore, that means you need many different places of getting care and many different sources of inputs, some of which are medical and some of which are not medical, but they're health-supporting behaviors. And so we have to agree they're going to be there. Number two, you have to agree, and we don't have time to talk about it today, that prevention, as key as it is got to start in communities. And population-based prevention is important, but that's not what this subject is. So number three, health risk appraisals. Individuals now being given tools to determine, here is what my health is, and here are my challenges. And that information being shared with the care delivery system in a way that can be shared with others. So it really highlights, I got some key things here that need to be attended to and the system has to address. Sometimes when we get those health risk appraisals back now, there are such scary things in there that we got to pick up the phone and call you and say, hey, we got to have a conversation right now because you are in deep doo-doo. Can you say doo-doo here? I'm sorry. Number four. Combined with health risk assessments is a new era of data being collected around all the other stuff we know about you and putting it into analytic systems and doing something called predictive modeling. We are getting very good in healthcare today, finally, at being able to say, you know, given this, 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 and this, the chances that you're going to have a problem in 5 years are pretty high. You know, we got to do something with you, personally, directly with you, because we can sort of predict things that are going on. Number five, then targeted messaging. What healthcare stinks at is what Amazon is great at. What Barnes & Noble is great at, what iTunes is great at. They know me. They know I just bought Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, four times. They know that I'm going to be open to the new Kind of Blue by Miles Davis. And they're going to, as soon as it's out there, they're going to call, hey, Reed, you really want to come talk to me. They know me. Healthcare doesn't really do a good job, but we're getting good in consumerism around understanding who you are and what level of activation you are to get engaged. My kid will live forever, doesn't care what I say, impenetrable, returns kickoffs for his college football team. Just bulletproof. Me, I get every disease I think that's coming to man. So I'm paying attention to everything. People are different in terms of their level of engagement. And so we in healthcare have to get very good at being able to assess their level of engagement and then help people where they are at that moment. Then we have very serious targeted messaging that allows us to do that. Next, benefit design. We can preach and beg and beg and preach. Do you know that 21% of American people still smoke tobacco? 21% of American people still smoke tobacco. Now, all that we've been through, 21% of American people still smoke, the number one killer in the Western world. After you finish begging, if you are a private sector employer, and you're going to say, wait a minute, look here, Mr. Jones, come on. You are costing everybody around you a ton of money in healthcare expenses because you won't stop smoking tobacco. We're going to have some kind of a financial or other incentive, which we'll hopefully get into later, that sort of says either stop or you're going to have a problem. Number seven, selecting the hospital or physician. Next time you pass by your newsstand and you see whatever city you live in, St. Louis, Chicago, best hospitals in St. Louis, just laugh. It's ridiculous. Doodly squat relevance. Because what you want is the best hospital for you, not for everybody else. And there ain't no hospital that's best for everybody. I want the one for you. And so now the trick is to marry you with that place that's right for you, that doctor that's right for you. Quickly, then decision support coaching. A whole bunch of you are going to kind of read this stuff. You're going to be excited. You're going to go online. You like my personal messaging. You don't trust the health plan because we gave it to you. I don't care who it is. You don't trust anybody. And you say, wait a minute, I got to talk to somebody. Well, now consumerism is that companies now are having people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on the phone waiting for you to call them. And say, let's talk it through. Let's help you to make – my mom can't make sense of this. This is not her deal. So she needs to be able to chat with somebody, and so we're getting that going forward. And then benefit design, again, on if you decide to choose Little Sisters of St. Elsewhere on Fifth and Vine, because that's where you were born, but they kill people every other day, and the rework is too high, and hey, that's on you. You go there, but you're going to pay more than if you went to man's greatest hospital. Last two, care coordination. We're going to have to really work hard in helping people to navigate through what you are absolutely right about is this fragmented, crazy system, be able to get people to coordinate a variety of services and help them to manage their own disease. The people have to be participants with their doctors in this environment. And then lastly, the most probably one of the most exciting things, and right on time, is you've got to tell the moderator she hasn't gone crazy, the marriage of financial services with health services. Now, finally, we are seeing a now of smashing together. So when you go to the doctor's office, you swipe a card, eligibility determination, the card dumps you right into the computer system of companies like ours. You know what we know at that point. The physician pulls up a personal health record, populated, pre-populated with everything that we can possibly know about you so they don't prescribe medication you're already on or medication that's incompatible with you. Then you have the experience that is done in the clinic. You come out of the clinic, the doctor sends in the bill, already pre-populated with all the stuff on it. Then you decide right at that moment how much do you owe, how much does the health plan owe, right on the spot, real time. Then the patient can say, okay, here's my banking card, all part of the same deal. Everybody, you sort of settle up right then. The doctor isn't scared about having to run after you to collect the bill, and you sort of put all that stuff together, and at the end of it, you send the bill directly to the doctor's bank account, taking all that waste, all that paperwork, all that extra cost out. That's where we are today with consumerism, but of course, as we get into later, there are some challenges to fully implement that vision.
Wonderful.
All right.
Victor.
How do you follow that act? I love his enthusiasm. I guess I'm going to have to give you some reality. But what I like to do, however, is being a physician, the head of a health system, also a chancellor who looks at research, education, I'm going to try to bring it down to earth, but really hopefully telling you that what we're trying to do and what's really needed in the future. So Gary talked about behavior, and I agree that behavior is a really big driver of everything that we have, in fact, in healthcare, from the patient all the way to the providers. A behavior also in the terms of incentive and dollars. But also we have to put in the system. Now, if you listen to what Reed said, I said, boy, that's wonderful. We just put a kiosk at Duke and people are swiping in. They don't have to wait in line. We get the data. But if you imagine our challenges across the country and how many different fragmented systems we have and who's going to put the kind of coordinated money into it, I think that's what the issue is. So when I think about consumerism, talk about behavior, I like the Milton Friedman analogy. When a man spends his own money to buy something for himself, he's very careful how much he spends and how he spends it. When a man spends his own money to buy something for someone else, he's still very careful about how much he spends, but somewhat less on what he spends it on. When a man spends someone else's money to buy something for himself, he's very careful about what he buys, but doesn't care at all about what he spends. That's the current state of our healthcare. And I think the discussion about trying to get consumers and try to get take more ownership is what this is all about. Now, I like to speak from a perspective of a healthcare leader who can influence policy. As a delivery system and medical center, hospital, clinics, where we have physicians and we have to provide care, as a physician myself, but also as an employer, because I'm the fourth largest employer in North Carolina. We employ about 40,000 people in our healthcare system. From all those four perspectives, I would say that consumerism philosophically is a good thing. A knowledgeable patient, informed patient can make choices, who's going to have to make choices and who's going to have to put some skin on the game is a very good thing. So when it comes to healthcare, of course, I think that patients want to know what's the quality, what's the cost, what's the access, and so on and so forth. Now, like everything in life, if you take things to extreme, on the other hand, consumerism can have its downsides. If you think about, cost shifting, too much cost shifting from employees to employees who may not be able to afford it. If you think about patients who make decisions strictly on price and not on quality. Or you think that patients have lousy information, therefore you don't know what the real quality is to make that decision. Or adverse selection, because of the consumer-driven health plans. And health illiteracy. I think you're dealing with a lot of people who, in fact, don't understand medicine and have great literacy in this, and also people who don't have access to information technology. So we could leave a whole bunch of people behind as well. Now, so I think that a consumerism for patient, the requirements are, as you heard, transparency. You want to know what you're getting exactly for your money, and what that's like when you buy a car or you buy a home. Information you want that is available, easily formatted, so you can decide what kind of information do I need to make decisions. Access, affordable options to attain care. Quality, which is very important. How do you know one doctor is better than the other or one medical center? We can put a band and say we're the best, but you know, how do you really measure that? And of course, education. That turns out to be, in my opinion, one of the most important issues in consumerism, because if you're not educated, how can you choose? And I think we have education not only about patients, but physicians, right? And in fact, not only that, but also families, providers, and others. The problem is that we do have a lot of challenges, and I completely agree with what's been said by Reed. It's the ideal situation. Now, I'd like to ask him, how would he do it, and how soon can we do it? So let's talk about price and quality. Go and look at the hospitals and clinics at doctor's offices, and you look at posting. How many people are really posting prices? Not too many, right? And if you ask the average doctor, you ask me when I see a patient, I probably can't tell you how much it's going to cost when you do certain testing or certain therapy. And that alienates the patient, because the patient feels they're not part of a decision-making process because the doctor's not helping me. information on quality data. I think David talked about this. When I first, I would say about 10 years ago, when I was in Boston at Partners Healthcare System, which is Mass General and Brigham Women's Hospital, we're beginning to be asked by lots of different systems, Leapfrog and others, to say, how do we measure how good you are? Now, I think it's becoming a way of life, but the problem is, it's so, shall we say, that there's so many different systems that ask for quality that we just push in the data, and in fact, it's not standardized. So it depends on what you look at and what system you look at. It's really hard to compare apples and oranges. What we need is a national standard by which we can measure these things appropriately. But given the fact that if you're in a tertiary care hospital, you're going to have more complicated cases than if you are in the primary care hospital or community hospital. Those things have to be adjusted. And lack of standardization of measurements and information. Now, I think information technology is the key, as you said, and I think it's woefully inadequate. Electronic health records, information on cost, et cetera. And I think that's got to be a huge next step. So I'd like to make three points in my discussion from my perspective. First, let's talk about me as an employer. I think for so many of you in this audience, you're employers. I'm going to use the word employerism because I think that goes hand in hand with consumerism. Because if an employee cares about the consumers, treats their employees as consumers of health, and helps them think about how to get the best health, it will be a lot more effective, not just pushing the price down. So I think Gary talked about incentive. Well, imagine that if you have an employee who's incentivized to be healthier, it's going to cost you, save you money, it's going to give them more incentive. Imagine that you have a physician who's incentivized to make sure the patient gets better. That, too, would be aligned, so the alignment. So I want to tell you a program we have at Duke we call Prospective Health, which is started by Ralph Snyderman, my predecessor. And we have, because we have a large number of employees, we make this available to them as an enrollment. It's optional. And because we have our own managed care system, we can measure how much money we save by doing this. The idea is a personal report card, so risk assessment. So the doctor and the patient centricity, the patient will sit down and say, okay, let's do a report card. I've just done your risk assessment. What do you need to do to improve your health? You list the kind of things that you want to do in 1 year, you want to list the kind of things you want to do in 5 years. And then at the end, then you do individualized coaching and incentive. At the end of the year, if you met your report card in terms of reduction in, say, smoking or weight loss, the patient gets an incentive. It usually is a deductible, a reduction in their deductibles. The physician actually gets incentive so that both of them work together to try to, in fact, work together to reach those kind of goals. And I can tell you on a select population, the high-risk tier, the third tier who have more diseases, we've seen that in 2 years, our what we call per member per month have gone down close to $100, about $500 to $400. It's phenomenal. If you translate that into large, all the employees that we have, or to other businesses, you can imagine the savings. So I agree with you that these kind of things we need to think about to put into place. Second point is providers. We talked about how physicians must learn to work as a team and that we need to put incentive for physicians to work together as a team. So already we talked about how you can incentivize physicians. Even though $200 for a patient when the employee met the report card, it's amazing what people would do because they feel they've been rewarded, not just this is part of the churning the patient. So that's very important. We have to provide them with a system. So someone mentioned 25 patients an hour, or whatever number it is. But if you don't have a system, an information technology system, the doctors can slow down and read, but there's nothing he can tell you because he can't find the information. The patient wants to access the system too. So we have put, in fact, websites where there's information. We have recently created a Duke Health portal that actually patients can now go and look at their lab results. They own their record, medical record. They can look at physician notes. Actually, we have them in there. referring physician relationships, service access, and billing. They track their billing. Now, we just kicked this off. It was covered in Wall Street about 3 months ago, and we're looking forward to actually doing this more effectively. But my point is that if health systems, hospital, medical centers start to do this with the right support, then I think we can get much closer to what you want to be. Finally, the role of an educator. So as the chancellor, the deans of the School of Medicine, School of Nursing, the health extenders all report to me. What we have to do is begin thinking about how to educate our providers to be good stewards of healthcare, prevention, consumerism, how to help the patient. And that's going to be very key. And as you said, if they don't work together as a team and you give people the incentive to work individually, that's never going to happen. So I think the final point I want to make about consumerism is we better wake up, because as we look at, talk about globalization and talking about all the things about global economics, you all know that, in fact, there are people who are now sending patients over to India, to other places for much lower cost and arguably maybe comparable quality. And if we in the United States don't try to improve our system where the quality is great and the price is down, I think we're going to see a significant shift of employers sending their employees overseas. So it's not just us saying we're better, but in fact we have to do it much better and provide quality as well as access. So what I want to do is give you the kind of perspective from a physician viewpoint, from a person who runs a health system and medical clinics, also from an educator viewpoint, that all these things will be aligned and we need to work together to make it work. Thank you.
Thank you, Victor. Ram.
I'll try to be quick. I mean, I came from the Clinton White House where we basically, in my view, captured healthcare reform. One with, everybody knows, the healthcare reform failure of 1994, the universal care, and then also the creation of SCHIP with its children's healthcare program for children whose parents work full-time but don't have healthcare. And here's my view. I've been asked to speak about this, but on what the next president may face in Congress. There have been four attempts at universal care in the United States: Truman, Johnson, Nixon, and Clinton. Not exactly, from one politician's view, four schlumps when it comes to politics, and four guys failed. Three out of the four had Democratic, their own party, controlling both the House and Senate. So the failure rate in creating universal care in this country is a beaten path. A lot of people have been there, done that, seen it. It's a bad rerun movie. Where we have succeeded as a country is not universal care for the population, but universalizing care for segments of the population. Medicare, Medicaid, veterans, SCHIP, which I had done for Clinton, which is a children's program. That is where we have done successful universal care. It is not what you would do in the sense of trying to, if you're rewriting the system, you wouldn't do it, but it's reforms given the existing structures, and usually our outgrowths when you realize universal is not a way you can succeed at getting health care. I think the next president of the United States and the next Congress, I say with a little confidence that it will be Democratic here, will face a choice. You've never had the stars and the moons aligned better for universal care. For the first time, corporate America, rather than sitting in the back seat saying, you know, I'm for universal care, and then the first speed bump in the road, they jump out the back seat and never to be seen again in advocating it, are now not only in the front seat, push labor into the back seat, they're in the front seat grabbing a hold of the steering wheel, desperate to get some form of a universal care because they want to get out of the asset, basically out of the system of what I would call both on retirement and health care, out of the management of those benefit programs. You also have the cost driven that way. On the other hand, just as this one person's analyst of politics, I couldn't see the stars and moons more aligned against universal health care. And it may not be in politics conventional wisdom. And the reason I say that is a president will face an inordinate amount of time unwinding Iraq and containing the disaster. An inordinate amount of time. In 2010, the AMT, the alternative minimum tax, will go from 3.4 million to 23 million people, all hitting the middle class. George Bush's tax cut, first one, expires in 2010. So you have a colliding of those events. And you have X amount of political capital. Do you spend it on trying to universalize healthcare where four presidents have failed? Or do you have a tax code where you try to get a victory going into a reelect? I know what one former advisor to a president would advocate. So I think there's three buckets to look at. Universal care, where you for the first time can get both control and cost, which should usually be rather act universal care and cost control, which have usually been at loggerheads, aligned. Two, what I call bucket number two, which is IT, where you got about $200 billion of free low-hanging fruit money to be picked up. What I call the chronic care illnesses, obesity, diabetes, et cetera, and try to wring out of the system about $500 billion, which I think is real money that's there. And bucket number three, which is expanding SCHIP with the children's program, we're going to do this Congress, bringing it up to about 350% of poverty from 200%. Take Medicare down from where it is at 65 to the early retirees, trying it out on the auto industry. We'll take your early retirees, but you have to invest in high, you know, in better cars, et cetera, from energy, et cetera. So bring these public programs into other population sectors and get to a universal care that way and get better cost control. Believe it or not, contrary to conventionalism, the government, both Medicare, Medicaid, and SCHIP, and veterans, is a better delivery system on health care, no disrespect, Reed, to a lot of private companies out there. And I think Medicare does a better job on retirees and therefore should be in the early retiree business. It has a core proficiency much better than the private sector. Those are the three buckets. I think we're about to reauthorize the Children's Health Insurance Program. You have to do these every 10 years. If it gets done, it tells you, I think, what will happen next. If it fails, which I don't think it will, but it's a high probability, you know, you have a lot of vested interest in its failure, not its success. I think the next president will go for a more minimalist approach on healthcare rather than universal. And that's just, you know, you presidents have X amount of political capital. You got to figure out how to go spend it, where to earn it, and what you have to do. And if anybody thinks for a moment the next president of the United States is not going to spend an inordinate amount of their political capital on Iraq, I got a bridge over the Tigris River you could buy. They're going to spend a tremendous amount. And the domestic front, although these are a lot of crushing, you're going to have to do something on global warming, et cetera. I think the notion that you're going to go take on universal health care, where four presidents have failed, you're going to have a buy-in by the private sector, the public, and the public sector in a way that has never existed before. It's possible, but I'm going to say this. I think Lyndon Johnson was quite a good pal. I think Nixon was quite a good pal. I'm a little biased. I happen to think Bill Clinton's quite a good pal. All of those three, plus Truman, failed at universal health care. There's a lot of vested interests that any movement in that, you know, just you move one piece at the bottom, it ripples across the system. So I think what happens in what the president does in the remaining 18 months on Iraq and what we do in Congress as reauthorizing the Children's Health Care Program will tell you a lot about what I think can happen in the next 4 years of a new administration.
Great. Thank you, Rom.
Yeah.
If I may, what I'll do is ask two questions, hoping that you will bail me out thereafter. Rom, may I start with you since we ended with you? You know personally all three or four of the top Democratic candidates for president. Could you give us something that's behind the scenes? Could
no.
you tell us?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, David.
Could you tell us, as to this issue, who's most serious about health care? This is what they actually the thing they want to do. Who's most cunning on health care? Who's most aggressive? Just something we can't know, but you do know by knowing these leading politicians.
Well, if you haven't gotten the New York Times today, I think Robin Toner has a pretty good piece about everybody's, it's a cursory at 10,000 feet, their plans. But it does reflect, I think, who they are and where they're from. And that is, I think, there's no doubt Senator Clinton, Hillary's been through, is battle-tested on health care, knows the vested interests, et cetera. And she has quite invested in the IT area. Now, any person, if you invested $10 billion but you get $200 billion, anybody in business and any board would say, go put the $10 billion down. She's got a great IT program. And she, although leans heavily towards universal, understands it may be done in slices of the salami.
Is she burned on this issue and gunshot?
Well, a lot of us have some scars to show from if you're interested. But, yeah, I mean, there is. It's not burnt. She knows you have to do it, and I admire her for two things. First of all, one little story. I mean, when I and I can't get away from telling the story. She's not burnt, but she's battle-tested is the way I would say it. When I did the SCHIP program for President Clinton, we had a pediatric care, eye, and dental through Medicaid. The Republicans had pediatric care, no eye and dental, outside of Medicaid. It was the last item in the balanced budget agreement. And we were sent in to go, the president wanted his balanced budget and he also wanted his health care plan. So what Chris, you will hear from later, and I, and with the president's approval, cut a deal. We would get pediatric care and eye and dental for the kids, but we would do it outside of Medicaid, the Republican funding mechanism. Now the left ripped, I started this job 6'2 and 250 pounds. The left ripped the hell out of me. Today, but it's based on a 65 federal funding, 35% state funding. Medicaid varies per state. Why a lot of states during recessions cut Medicaid is because, you know, they don't do that in the SCHIP program because it's a better financing model for them. I got the hell beat out of me for it, but it is a better program for the children than that. Now, she knows, she was part of those negotiations and part of that agreement and came right back. What I admire about her, you know, beaten on healthcare, basic yeah. view, would, yeah, you know, I've done that, been there, not going to do it, comes back with another program, big thing like to do. Now, Barack was in the Senate, very involved in a number of things, not only the EITC expansion, but also in the children's health care plan that's designed by Illinois, which I will tell you is, since I'm also involved in it, one of the best state programs for children and parents who work full-time but without health care. The other person I would say is Chris Dodd, who I think has a very, very good program. Each of them come from an experience. Barack from a state level, which has more experience with Medicaid and a children's health. It doesn't have other things. Mm-hmm. Senator Clinton, seeing vested interests that, you know, if you want to see a good political dogfight, say health care reform, and you'll get all everybody who has a vested interest in the system out with money to spend and to burn. So all of them have, and again, I think that, you know, no, there's nothing perfect about my three buckets. I could see, if you look at also the history, each one of those segments, Medicare, Medicaid, veterans, SCHIP, came out of somebody who tried universal and fell back on a universalization for population. So you may decide to march uphill 519 for universal health care and go for bringing Medicare down to the age fit for early retirees, the fastest growing uninsured population in America. People between the ages of 55 and 65. Fastest growing group of uninsured in America. Growing, not the biggest, right. Fastest in the growing sense of population. So both of them are, I think their healthcare systems reflect their experiences and their background. And that is as good a dodge as you're going to get in politics.
It was also very interesting. Thank you. Let's go straight to questions. Who would like to come forward? Do we have the mics working?
Let's try it.
I would like to ask the question of health delivery systems. In the United States, we have one system, but in India, there are many other alternative systems that have been highly successful in high-volume eye care, heart care delivery. And what are we doing to look at ways of delivering better health care to more people?
Better. You going to go?
You go first.
No, I've spoken twice.
Victor, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. So I'm not sure what you mean by having one single delivery system. I think we've got lots of different delivery systems. I think what you have is a Medicare system for a large number of payer systems. So I think really the issue you're asking is, what's the most effective way to deliver care at the greatest price? And I think this is where the whole challenge, in my opinion, resides, which is that we all in different health delivery systems, such as mine at Duke, is trying to find a way by which we can look at preventive care, we can look at patient engagement, we can look at incentive for patients, and ultimately like to reduce the encounter with regards to complicated tertiary care. And so I think that's probably where the whole, in my opinion, where the delivery system stands.
Thank you. Yes, please.
I think you've done a superb job of talking about the multitude of issues that confront us. It seems like one of the major themes is the bad behavior issue. And talking about solutions, could Dr. Zhao possibly describe in more detail, or anyone, the solution that would be politically acceptable to the representative and to the country for the tobacco problem or the obesity problem that would make a difference in the statistics and in the data?
I think my colleagues would say that, and they would agree, that focusing on chronic disease, focusing on prevention and wellness, and also getting away from the doctor-centric model to a patient-centric model. So in other words, if you think about the chronic disease, diabetes, hypertension, many of these are outpatient care. In fact, they can be well managed, in my opinion, if you're not dealing with complicated patients, by a whole set of algorithms, by nurse practitioners, by information technology, by going much closer to the patient's home than having to come in to drive into the city to the medical center, doctor's office. So the consumerism, the emergence of the minute clinics, the variety of other quick ways of accessing care, actually, I happen to think it's not a bad idea if, in fact, we can assure quality. And this is not a money-making scheme. But, in fact, it's a much better way of reaching to the patient and the community, particularly if they are living in rural areas. So I think the emphasis on prevention, chronic care, getting away from a doctor's office issue, but more closer to accessing clinics close by and using protocols and information technology in terms of treating patients, I think is the direction to go. And that may also answer the question about the systems that you're talking about.
Reed, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I would just sort of add, one of the great things about this Aspen Ideas Festival and the multidisciplinary nature of it is that underlying your question is this is not just a healthcare issue. And so this is ultimately an issue of how we live our lives. And that is, of course, a series of very complex things. So it begins first and foremost with what's going on in our communities. What is it about the norm of our life that encourages and supports people being obese at the level that they are, and we really are prepared to just let it keep going and going and without any real activity? I really enjoyed Friedman's comments yesterday about the energy issue. And it's the same level of passion and urgency that has to be around something like that. Yet we are not prepared, you know, we have a party. We talk about it in abstract terms. But it is ultimately urban planners. It is ecologists. It's going to be the church leaders. It's community-based institutions. Those people that determine the course of how life is lived. Because the patient with obesity and its subsequent problems arises from a community of people, has a therapeutic experience, and then returns to a community of people where life is lived. So this is not, and it would be terribly unfair, if Victor and his physicians at Duke were left holding the bag, you figure this out, you solve this problem, because they can. Secondly, it will, of course, mean that we must give people information in ways in which they can use it. One of the things we have to be careful about is bad behavior. What that sometimes is not what you meant by your question, is we translate that into blame the victim. So it's like, okay, you are a crappy human being and just die. And the government has no responsibility to deal with you. Just say no.
It's just definitely not a re-election strategy, I'll tell you that. Okay?
So that may
be what you guys do at United Health. That ain't a re-election strategy.
You're not running for office.
So you have to be very careful about how do we help people, which is why I put so much emphasis and why I am enthusiastic about the lessons being learned outside of healthcare about how do you reach people. People in other industries seem to have a pretty good idea of talking to people about complex things in words they understand and in ways in which how many of you do your financial planning online? Complicated stuff. You figure it out some kind of way, and so do other people who don't have the PhDs that you have. So there's a new level of information. Third, finally, quickly, what it means then is there has to be a different relationship between you and your caregiver. And there has to be an incentive for the caregiver to want to be involved. So the caregiver's got to be on the line. But the caregiver is saying, hey, if I'm going to get involved in all that complex stuff that doesn't have anything to do with passing a medicine to you, and it's beyond just the medicine stuff to a bunch of fuzzy social science stuff, which really wasn't the stuff that you got to earn your spurs on in med school, you got to pay me for it. Or there has to be some alignment of my reimbursement. So that's happening as well. So I'll have to stop there in the interest of time. But what I'm trying to emphasize is the thing about the genius of the Aspen Institute is it's saying, hey, don't come in here and try to tell us there's a single solution to any of these complex problems. You better figure out how to work across disciplines. And I think you hit the key one.
Let me just build on a couple of points. One, putting people at economic risk seems like a really blunt instrument. And in and of itself, it is. But it is a part of the solution, in my view. In the research we've done with consumers who are in traditional insurance and in these higher deductible plans, one of the things they report, a few things they report, we don't know how to navigate the system, you got to help me, but one important thing they report is, I have changed my time horizon for how I think about my health care. It used to be weeks and months, I have to go to the doctor or not, I have a dentist appointment, 2 years. That's a good thing. It's a start. It's a good thing if we can do that. Second, to the point about how do you enter and work in the system, this is a bit of a pipe dream, and I don't know if this will ever happen, but I actually believe we need to redefine the menu of clinical services it is that you go and consume. It is not a consumer menu. It is a menu supply driven by doctors through the medical schools and the community. It's around physician departments. Take LASIK surgery. That's a procedure, but what is the promise? 2020 vision. No more glasses, no more hassle. That's a benefit. I, as a consumer, can value, can see, it creates competition. It used to be $2,500, now it's $1,000 an eyeball, whatever. As you wade into the system itself, it is so bewildering because it's all input driven. I get an x-ray, I get a test, they take some blood. If I'm a diabetic, fine, but what's the result? Tell me about my longevity. Am I going to lose my eyesight? We have to change the whole definition. And that is very hard to do, I'll admit. I think it's doable, but we won't have a consumer-driven system until we do that.
Ron.
I don't mean to. I'm going to be a slight skunk at the party. I'm for consumer-driven healthcare, but it's not an accident. Everybody's anecdote or example is the what is called basically the chronic illnesses, whether it's overweight, smoking habit, et cetera, because those are the easiest to alter on a price structure. You got cancer. You got something else. I would be shocked if anybody's a good consumer. I would be shocked in the kind of cost-conscious approach. Okay, so understand it's a very good thing. It probably is very good at taking out some of the low-lying fruit, about $500 billion out of a $2 trillion industry. I'm all for it. But let us not take that metaphor or business model all the way upstream to different types of illnesses where it really not only doesn't belong, would actually cost you more money. And I'm supposedly going to be, from United Health's example, probably a good consumer, work out 6 days a week, eat well, et cetera. The last person you want to leave with decisions on medical care would be the son of a doctor.
Yeah. Reed, okay? Moment of administration before we go, just for the four of us. We have four people standing, so let's make our objective. We have 10 minutes left to make sure we honor each of those four.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Remember, this is from the guy that says, go die. Okay.
I'm not the one who said, don't do that. Set the record straight.
But pay your premium first.
Let me just, real quick then.
Don't worry, it's all on video,
Reed. I would take it a little differently when Ram is. I think that it's important. Look, it is also this consumerism, and I went through it real fast in my menu, and I won't elaborate it now, is also on how you choose your doctor and how you choose your hospital. It is exceedingly important that you are engaged as a consumer in the choice around where you go for that very important surgery. In fact, the more complex and expensive and difficult that surgery is, the more you want to be informed and engaged in the process of selecting it, because at the end of the day, that's your life. And I will tell you, there is a very clear relationship, a striation, but in terms of quality, safety, appropriateness between hospitals. So you definitely want to be engaged.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is that there has to be an investment in information technology, because if you have garbage in, garbage out. So the information becomes a critical issue. We're not there yet.
Okay. Hi, I'm Tina Staley, and I really appreciate the dialogue around bad behavior, prevention, but I'm just curious, when there's such a high cost of medical care that's spent the last year of a patient's life, and especially with an aging population, what are you doing to manage this cost?
How about Reed?
Yeah, very quickly, first of all, the care at the end of life is where so much of the money is spent. And one of the things we really do know a lot about, again, is extraordinary and unexplainable variation in the use of healthcare assets, the quality of care that is delivered to people at the end of their life. And so one of the things that's happening, people like Jack Weinberg, who I would commend you to really just pull up on the Google and read the work of Jack Weinberg, who will explain this in ways that will make you not only angry, but also at least with clarity. But the issue then becomes is the performance assessment and the performance evaluation around quality and the cost effectiveness of care at the end of life is becoming very transparent so that you and your family will have a chance to see it. But probably what's most important is for you and your family to decide to do an advanced care directive. Still, very few people in the country have really sat down by themselves or shared with their family. This is what I want for myself when I am in a position not to be able to make decisions for myself. I would say those are at least two things that are important.
I know this is, we got to get through everybody. I would say, if you're looking for a mindset change on healthcare, that's the hardest hill you're going to climb, is the last year of a life from a sense of perspective, a healthcare delivery, et cetera, because that is the hardest cultural hill that you'll have to, that we would, as a society, say, what's not accessible to somebody that can afford it is not accessible to everybody. And that would be the biggest mind change you could have, and I wouldn't call it a 20-year project. I think that's a bigger project over a period of time. That's just one man's view.
Hello, Dr. Tuckson, this is directed at you. I'm Carol Siegel, and I'm a trustee of Rush University Medical Center. We have not been able to get into any negotiated contracts with you for several years. and the reason is...
These are usually what we get, man.
Hey, listen, you know what? Good trustees do this kind of stuff, right? Anyway, it's in Chicago, and we're on the west side of Chicago. And actually, what has happened is, we the provider, you don't provide us with enough that we can stay solvent with what you give to us. We are in a poor neighborhood, half poor, half rich neighborhood. Some of that becomes a distribution of wealth. You know, we take from the rich, and then they help pay for some of those poor people who come in who we never, never, ever turn away. Anyway, I'm just asking you, I know the businesses are in such a bind, you know, that they have to cut the best deal possible, you know, from you, you know, but would you like to comment about how this is really affecting the hospitals? And we'd like to have you back, but...
So I'll be real, real quick, and hopefully we'll talk outside of that. Okay. But we have been able to figure this out for 5,000 hospitals, so, you know, you certainly, but everyone is important. I think the real thesis you're trying to get us to describe here in terms of what's germane to everybody is, and you've said it right at the end, there is an extraordinarily dynamic tension between the people that are paying for health care, all those customers, and we've got, you know, all the Fortune 100 and 200 and 300s, all the way down to the mom and pop operating a printing plant, you know, in South Central LA. And all of them are sort of saying to us, you had better be extremely tough and effective at keeping these escalation in hospital and physician salaries and so forth and so on. What you're saying is, while we are doing that work, be aware of the secondary consequences as you squeeze out maybe sometimes too much so that you can't minister to the poor, especially when you take on that responsibility and maybe some other folks in your town who don't have those uncompensated care deals and they're just sitting flying by feeling good. And you're saying be fair. And so trying to figure out what is fair and do right on behalf of all them people that are trying to pay it and keep their employees employed and do right by you is a hell of a negotiation, a balancing act. And obviously, we didn't solve that very well, according to you, so I'm going to have to see you outside.
David, you're very good. David. Victor.
I appreciate what you just said, because if you think about what I've been saying about how we at Duke or any medical center tries to solve a problem, being a good citizen, and trying to think about aligning incentive, creating information technology, et cetera, it all comes from these dollars, right? And if there's insufficient dollars, then, you know, a lot of places are not going to do it. And then the where we want to be is never going to be there until we have a change of reimbursement as well.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mel Spira, a physician of 51 years. Everett Koop, a number of years ago, said that the American people want the best health care, they want it cheap, and they don't want to wait for it. He said, I can give you any two of the three, not all of them. No country in the world, he says, delivers to its people all those factors. And the question I have is, first, can we become the first country that does it? And secondly, if you had to adjust one of those factors, which ones do you think the American people will accept?
Good question. Healthcare seems to be the only industry where cost and quality are opposed. In every other one where we have high quality, we have low costs. I don't believe healthcare is any different in the sense that economics apply. I do believe that, as we talked about, we have lots of misaligned incentives. We have a highly fragmented system. We have all these issues we talked about behavior. And I don't think we've had the bandwidth to actually, or frankly, the will to operate on all of these at once. I'm opposed, not opposed philosophically, to things like universal health care. It's a question of how do you do it. If you do it with the current insurance model, we're not going to save any money. We're not going to do much good, frankly, because Dr. Zhao's hospital is already paying for about three-quarters of that care. They call it uncompensated care. Now, if we can come to the meeting of the minds about incentives and the way we structure the system, I see no reason, in theory, I'll put it in theory, that you can't have all three aligned.
Thank you, sir, for 51 years.
Right.
In view of the hour, I'll be very quick. I do need to say, just so that you understand where I'm coming from, who I am, I am a very well-trained hematologist and oncologist, now retired. I was trained at Harvard and Yale at the National Cancer Institute. In addition to that, I sat for 4 years on the National Oversight Committee of the Department of Healthcare Management at the Harvard Medical School under Barbara McNeil. I finally got off kind of in disgust because of one of the weaknesses that I saw on that committee and in that department, which I see on the stage as well. And that is that I don't think you're ever going to solve this problem unless one of the people that's on your panelists is a practicing physician. Now, I don't mean that you don't see patients.
You don't think spin doctor counts? I said you don't think spin doctor counts as a
no. Okay. No, I don't. Spin doctor is real, but I don't think it counts. And by the way, just for the record, I'm not a member of the AMA, and have not been. My point is, I agree completely that the system needs to be changed. Until I hit Medicare last year, the only insurance I could get was catastrophic coverage, $36,000 a year for me and my wife. And I'm in good health except for well-controlled hypertension. So there's a real problem there. You'd think that Harvard would be a relatively liberal place. The committee was headed by Bill Fritch, whose money was made, as I think you probably know, in a healthcare management in a health management system. I tried very hard to get Barbara McNeil, the chair of the department, to appoint a Democrat, and she would not, for balance. Now, my point is that I think it's very good for people who know a lot about certain kinds of things to talk about these things and to make decisions. But I think that the people who deliver the care have to be involved as well. The last thing I want to say is that I want to very much emphasize something that was set up there. I spend most of my time now as a medical ombudsman. And what I mean by a medical ombudsman is that people do not have a quarterback. And reference was made in an indirect way to that up there. Quarterbacks have to be compensated. People don't want to be primary care physicians. They don't want to be general practitioners. They don't want to be general internists, because as soon as something is complicated, they get sent to somebody else. People come to me and they say, what does it mean? My doctor doesn't have the time. He's got to turn the patients over. I can't get an appointment. You know, that's what I spend my time doing now. And I think that those two things, the need for representation of the people who deliver the care, and secondly, the need for compensating the people who are really supposed to sit down with Mr. Jones or Mrs. Smith and say, I'm your quarterback, I'm the place where you come. I'll see that you get to the right person, but I'm the bottom line.
So completely agree with you. That's excellent. And by the way, please. And I just wanted two quick things in the interest of time. One is that it will not suffice for you here, but everything that we do, everything we do, at least in terms of a company like ours, is in collaboration with the Medical Specialty Society. So the intimacy between us and them is very great. And that's maybe a trend that you may not be aware of. But secondly, if you give me your card later or your address, I will send you. We will announce, our company will announce next week with the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American College of Physicians, and the American Academy of Pediatrics, a first time that we will start a trial in designed by them, all of us together, to pay primary care physicians to implement what's called the medical home, to be the quarterback, to align the incentives, to do everything that you just said. That press release, please don't tell anybody about it because it hasn't hit the thing yet. It'll hit Monday morning. I'll send you your copy. I absolutely agree with you. At least I can encourage you a little bit to say that the brilliance of your question is being implemented as we speak.
Rob. Well, first, I don't think anybody here was saying that primary care delivers shouldn't be part of a healthcare solution. I mean, the presumption of the panel was about how do you basically solve the healthcare riddle that has basically since World War II been at the heart of a public policy debate in our country. I would only suggest this, that although that view is important, it doesn't mean that it has to be in the driver's seat. And I say that both as a brother of a doctor and a son of a doctor and a nurse. It's helpful, as is the patient's perspective is helpful, as is the woman two questions before you who administers for a hospital, and I happen to know where Rush is in Chicago, and I'm going to go to that meeting with you. it is a perspective, a valuable perspective, but it doesn't jump to the front seat or the back seat. It's in the car with everybody else's.
I think that's a wrap. Thank you all very much.